Okay, I suppose I can start. You may know that talks today are on sale. You get two at the cost of one. I should thank Josef in the queue, first of all, for letting me speak first, despite he's older than me, and also for giving me the largest share of the time. I will talk for about half an hour. I would also like to thank, of course, the organizers of this program for giving me the opportunity of being here for the first time in my life, in fact. So today I'm going to talk about an experiment on Casimir effect in superconducting cavities that is going on in my university in Napoli. So let me first introduce a little bit the subject. As you may know, Casimir effect has been the subject of a lot of experimental work in the last, say, 10 years. Now, all experiments performed so far, to my knowledge, aim at measuring the Casimir force, mostly in two configurations: plane parallel, only one experiment, and sphere plate, or perhaps cylinder, two cylinders, two crossed cylinders or so. As far as I know, there are yet no experiments which measure directly effects relating to the Casimir energy per se. Now, in our views, it would be interesting to have experimental tests of two things. On one side, gravitational effects relating to Casimir energy. On the other end, and this is, the purpose of the experiment which I will talk today about is the influence of phase transitions on the Casimir energy. Now, I will say only a few words about Casimir energy and gravity. There is no time to speak about. This is an interesting problem. So the question we asked is, what is the weight of the Casimir energy? I mean, does it gravitate as one would expect on the basis of the equivalence principle of Einstein's general theory of relativity? Everybody's answer would be yes, of course. Well, what we did is a computation, an explicit computation of the stress energy tensor for the electromagnetic field, the quantum electromagnetic field, in the background of a weak gravitational field between two metallic plates. And the answer was as expected. Namely, the Casimir apparatus receives from the Casimir energy a push, a gravitational push. I don't know how to avoid this. W, which is equal to its mass times g, where the mass is given by Einstein's energy mass relation, as usual, Casimir energy over c squared. Now, the interesting thing is that the Casimir energy is negative for two parallel plates, and so the Casimir push is negative. So the cavity receives a push upwards. It's like a kind of anti-gravity, so to speak. Now, this is an interesting problem because when you compute the stress energy tensor for the electromagnetic field on the two plates, in order to see what is the net force, the net push, you have to take account of general relativity properly. And you discover, for example, that when you combine the two forces on the opposite plates to get the total push, forces undergo redshifts in the same way as frequencies do in general relativity. So it's very important, in order to get the correct answer, to take account of the fact that when you add up the Casimir pushes on the opposite faces, so you add up the two forces by transporting one from one phase to the opposite phase, you have to take account of the gravitational redshift also for the force. In this way, you get the correct answer. But anyhow, this is not the subject of today's talk. Today, I want to focus my attention on the connection between Casimir effect and phase transitions, namely, in particular, the superconducting phase transition. Now,
is there any chance that you could measure that?
We have measured it hopefully.
No, the first part.
Ah, the first thing. Well, you see, we need to find good means of modulating the Casimir energy inside the cavity by introducing as little energy as possible in the system. So that's why, in fact, we consider superconducting cavities, because we thought by modulating the transition, we could change the Casimir energy. And if you have a modulated signal, you can hope to get huge sensitivities and detect also the tiny effect of the Casimir energy on the gravitational, on the weight of the cavity. The effect is very small, of course, because the energy, Casimir energy, when you divide by c squared is. But you see, we made some estimates. For example, one of the people in our collaboration, Calloni, works with the Virgo experiment in Pisa. You know, this is the experiment aiming at detecting gravitational waves. Now, in principle, you can use this huge interferometer to measure, well, it's a force, it's an apparatus for measuring forces, small forces. And so we estimated that we are not that far. I mean, the sensitivity of a device like Virgo or LIGO here is not far from being able, for example, to detect this effect.
Can you give an order of estimate? I mean, let's say if you have mu distance.
Well, I can tell you that a typical Casimir energy for, I don't remember exactly now the numbers, but I think I remember that, say, for a separation of 100 nanometers and an area of 1 centimeter square, the Casimir energy is something about 1 erg, I remember, a few ergs, something like that. So if you divide by c square, you get.
If you look at the Casimir energy, how it's usually defined, you take basically the whole energy and then subtract the self energies of the objects, right? So that you just get an energy which depends on, say, L.
That's right.
So, but I mean, the self energies, they should also gravitate. So.
Yes. No, but I'm looking at the self energy of the plates.
Yeah, sure.
No, no, I'm taking account of how the weight of the apparatus changes when you modulate the Casimir energy. So supposedly the self energy of the plates is not going to be affected by the turning on of the Casimir energy. This is an assumption for us. Now, it looks reasonable, no, to think that the plates work as a background. I mean, whose energy is not affected much, whose self energy is not affected much by the presence of the small fluctuations. But this is an assumption for us. I cannot claim that it is, we have not checked it explicitly.
Excuse me, you said 1 erg, if I translate it incorrectly, it's something like 10 to minus 20 newtons. Or
it's very small, very small. You see, but the sensitivity of this gravitational wave apparatus, I mean, the key thing is to be able to modulate. Measuring a static force of that magnitude is impossible. But if you can have a modulation, so a time-varying push, then you can exploit the sensitivities of forces, systems, devices like the gravitational antenna. It's not far, really. I mean, the gravitational push. I mean, in order to detect the gravitational waves, you must really be able to measure extremely small forces of that magnitude.
So the prediction of gravity is already in calculation.
Yes, yes, yes. Because we compute the stress. But if we talk now about the gravitational thing, there will not be time.
Well, thinking is if you take a material,
yeah,
like a quaternion crystal,
yeah,
that has already lots of layers,
yeah,
and you were to rotate it,
yeah,
then as you rotate it with respect to gravity, this Casimir property
might change. Well, that's a suggestion we can consider. Let's say we should talk, because we got stuck there. We could not achieve a decent amount, a decent modulation of the Casimir energy. Decent, I mean 10% would be enough. If you have a multi-layer system and you use an apparatus like Virgo, you may be able to measure it. But anyhow, this is now another story. Today I want to talk of this other project, which is an ongoing experiment, as I told you. This work was done in collaboration with my friends in Naples, Enrico Calloni, Giampiero Esposito, and Luigi Rosa. And now what we did is the following. We consider a Casimir apparatus consisting of a thin superconducting film and a thick plate made of a normal metal, like gold, for example. And now, what is the idea? The question is, does the Casimir energy of the apparatus change, and by how much, when the superconducting film passes from the superconducting state to the normal state? Now, you would say yes. Why? Because clearly, as we know from Lifshitz theory, the Casimir free energy in a Casimir system depends on the reflective power of the mirrors. No? That's well known. Now, the optical properties of a metal film in the microwave region change a lot when the mirror becomes superconducting. I will show you pictures in a moment. So therefore, the conclusion you draw at once is that the Casimir force and free energy should change when the state of the film passes from normal to superconducting or vice versa. Now, the question is, how big is the effect? And is there any hope of detecting it? Now, what about trying a standard force measurement? A standard force measurement, a la Lamoureux, a la Moedin, I don't know. So is there any hope to see a sizable change of force, of Casimir force, in this process? Now, the answer is very difficult. We expect a change, a fractional change of the Casimir force of the order of 10 to minus 5 or 6 easily. And this is easy to understand. Why? The reason is given in this picture, which give you an idea of how the optical properties of a superconducting film differ from those of a normal film, just above the critical temperature. Now, from this picture, you see that the frequencies are measured in unit of KTC, where TC is the critical temperature. This is the right scale. And then you see that as soon as the frequency becomes a few times larger than KTC over H bar, the optical properties of the normal film are practically the same as those of the superconducting film. And now, this ruins you, because, as we know, if you have a Casimir apparatus with a separation A, the frequency range which determines the Casimir effect goes from zero to the characteristic cavity, frequency for the cavity, which is C over L. Now, for example, for a small L, like 20 nanometers, these are the numbers that we have in our experiment, this frequency corresponds to 10 electron volts. Now, in a micro, for a typical critical temperature of 1 Kelvin, the characteristic frequency that appears here is only 10 to minus 4 electron volts. So you are changing the reflective power of the mirrors in a tiny region compared to the huge frequency range which determines the Casimir force. And so more or less, if you take the ratio, you end up with the estimate that I gave you early. Fractional changes of Casimir forces should be very small, no? in this scenario. In fact, detecting the force is very, very difficult. Now, what was our idea? Let's see if there is a way to measure directly, not the change in the Casimir force, but the change in the free energy associated with the Casimir energy as the system passes from one state to the other. Now, what is this change of energy? Well, this change of energy should be positive, meaning that the normal state should have a larger Casimir energy than the less negative than the superconducting state, because roughly one could think that a superconducting mirror behaves more closely like an ideal mirror than a normal metal. So there should be more Casimir energy in the superconducting device than in the normal one. So delta FC should be positive. Is there a way to detect it? Yes. The idea, is there a power?
You're not connected to power?
No.
That's why the screen keeps dying.
Ah, it's this one, I suppose. No.
Maybe.
Where does it go?
In the back, yeah.
Yeah.
This end.
This. Ah, okay, this is why it was. Yes, so this is the idea. We should measure the parallel, the critical field, HC, which destroys the superconductivity of the film. Now, why is this idea going perhaps to work? You see, since the Casimir energy favors the superconducting state, as I said a minute ago, the critical field of a film which is part of a cavity should be slightly larger than the critical field of a similar film, which is a bare film. Okay, near to it, but not included in a Casimir cavity. Now, what is the point, which is very important? Since the shift of the critical field, I mean the difference in the critical fields of the film inside the cavity and a similar film which is not part of a cavity, just standing by itself, now depends on how the change of Casimir energy compares not to the Casimir energy itself, which is not important, but to the condensation energy of the film, which in fact is a very small quantity, orders of magnitude smaller than the Casimir energy. In this way, we may achieve, hopefully, a huge sensitivity, even to very, very small fractional changes of Casimir energy. This is the key idea. So I have to recall now a little bit what are the basic magnetic properties of superconductors. So you all probably know, I mean, that superconductors behave as perfect diamagnets. They expel magnetic fields. This is called the Meissner effect. But if you place a superconductor in a magnetic field which is strong enough, it destroys the superconductivity and penetrates the film. And this is called the critical magnetic field, the threshold. Now, how do you relate? How do you compute the critical magnetic field? It depends on the shape of the sample and on the direction of the magnetic field. But let's say that you have a thick sample and a parallel magnetic field, which is the simplest situation to consider. In this case, you can compute HC by equating the magnetic work which is required for the superconductor to expel the magnetic field to the condensation energy of the superconducting material. Now, you equate the two, and in this way you get an equation for the critical field. Or vice versa, if you measure the critical field, you get an estimate of the condensation energy as a function of temperature. Now, typically, the behavior of the critical field as a function of temperature is given by this well-known parabolic law. Okay. Now, if you have a thin film, things become a little bit more complicated because the magnetic field penetrates a little bit inside the film. The film is not thick enough to expel it efficiently. And then the magnetic work that you do is smaller. As a consequence, the critical field, which destroys the superconductivity of your thin film, becomes higher than for a bulk sample. Higher by a factor rho, which depends on the parameters that characterize your superconductor. This is not very important for us. It's only a technical detail. Now, what is really important is what happens when I place the superconducting film in a Casimir cavity. I mean, it becomes one of the plates of a superconducting apparatus. The other plate, as I said, being made of gold, normal metal. Well, again, this is the situation for the bare film. Condensation energy equal to the magnetic work. If the film is part of a cavity, then the magnetic work must equate not only the condensation energy, but the condensation energy plus the difference in the Casimir energies between the superconducting and the normal state. So as a consequence, the critical field which destroys the superconductivity of my film, part of a cavity, is shifted a little bit with respect to the corresponding value, same temperature, for a bare film. By how much? By the ratio, if you work out here the algebra, of the change in the free energy of the Casimir system over the condensation energy of the film. And this is the key equation. So you see, the fractional shift of magnetic field is not proportional to the fractional change of the Casimir energy, which is extremely small, but on the change in Casimir energy compared to the condensation energy of the film. This is the point. And now, if you look at the numbers for a typical film and a typical apparatus, you find that the Casimir free energy is something like 10 million times larger than the condensation energy of a film with a thickness of a few nanometers. So this means that even if you have a tiny change in the Casimir energy, it will be huge or sizable compared to the condensation energy, and so determine a sizable change of field. This is how the experiment works. Now, perhaps, how much time do I have?
10 minutes.
10 minutes? Okay. Now, so having set the framework, now what remains to be done? To compute the change in Casimir energy, no? Of course. Now, this is Lifshitz theory. But you have to take account, of course, of the response of a superconductor to a time-varying electromagnetic field, which is what you need in order to estimate Lifshitz theory. Now, in the first-order approximation, as you know, superconductors can be described by the two-fluid Casimir-Gorter system, in which you imagine that the conducting electrons are split in two phases. Normal electrons, which give the usual contribution to the conductivity, and the superconducting electrons, which give only a static DC contribution proportional to their density to the real part of the conductivity. Dissipation comes from the normal electrons, of course. So there are always some normal electrons in a superconducting system, there is also some dissipation at non-zero frequency necessarily. Now, the fraction of superconducting electrons behaves with temperature in this way. So for T equal TC, it is zero. There are no superconducting electrons. The transition is second order. At zero temperature, according to this simple model, all electrons are in the superconducting phase. Now, a more accurate estimate of the conductivity is provided by the BCS theory. Here, I don't have to go into too many details. This is the expression that we used for our computations. And here you see a plot of the real part of the conductivity as a function of frequencies measured in units of K Boltzmann TC for various temperatures of the sample. Okay. So as you see, there is no dissipation for frequencies below 2 times K Boltzmann TC over H bar. But then, if you use the BCS theory, there is a logarithmic tail, okay, near zero, and finally the delta-like contribution at zero frequencies. Anyhow.
So I like numbers. So, I want to look at the blue thing here and sort of think you want us to think about the solid line. Sharply changing.
This one?
Yeah.
As you increase the temperature, the behavior, this is the real part of the conductivity for a normal metal.
Right.
So when you increase the temperature, the real part of the conductivity of a superconductor gradually approaches the shape of the normal metal, as it should, because we have a second order phase transition. X-axis, sorry, are photon frequencies, I think, measured in units of h bar omega over 2 delta, where delta is the gap of the superconductor, which sets the natural scale for the frequencies.
I'm trying to remember, this is only the electric part of the response of the material or the magnetic response?
Both. I think they should describe in the local limit both things.
Do you have also a shift of TC?
Yes, in principle, but that I will come later. I come in a moment to this point. Let me, in principle.
I was wondering why you don't actually get the shift of H.
Because I'll come to that. If you just be patient for a minute, I will address this question. Now, you see, the idea is plug your BCS permittivity function into the Lifshitz formula and go ahead. Now, we know that Lifshitz theory, if you write the Lifshitz formula in terms of reflection coefficients, is valid also for superconductors, non-local media, spatial dispersion, in all cases. The only difference is that, depending on the medium constituting the plates, you have to use the correct expression of the reflection coefficients. No? Now, the issue is in our case. Since we have a low temperature superconductors, can we use the standard reflection coefficients a la Fresnel, which are valid in the case where no space dispersion is there? Is it reliable to do that? We believe it is correct because we have ultra-thin films. In ultra-thin films, it is known that the fringing part of the electrons usually does not grow very much. It is, in fact, sufficiently small for spatial dispersion to only give tiny corrections to the Casimir energy. So we proceeded using the local limit of BCS theory, which is so-called dirty limit of the theory. So using the dirty limit of the theory, in which case the permittivity is a function only of the frequency and not of the wave vectors, we go ahead computing the change in Casimir energy. Now, note that since the optical properties of the normal state are practically the same as those of the superconducting state for frequencies sufficiently larger than KTC, Now, the difference in Casimir energy is really determined by very small frequencies. This is interesting for those of you, if any, who are interested in this controversy on the low temperature, on the thermal correction to the Casimir effect in metallic systems. We believe that superconductors are a good tool to investigate this problem because precisely the change of Casimir energy is a low frequency thing in the Casimir context. So it is very sensitive to the prescriptions you use for the low frequency modes, which are at the origin of this controversy. But this is only a comment. So, okay, I do the computations using BCS theory. And perhaps I can be quick now at this point. I can go back if you want. But these are the results. So one learns two things, that the bigger shifts of magnetic field occur, rise near the critical temperature. Why? Because the condensation energy goes to zero as T approaches TC faster than the change in Casimir energy. So you see, this goes only like the first power of the reduced temperature, minus one. This goes like the square. So the, this ratio becomes larger and larger when you approach the critical transition. Of course, our theory is not reliable if you go too close to the transition, because then the Casimir energy perturbs the system, perhaps, in a significant way. So we believe that our theory should be used far enough from the transition, close to it, but not exceedingly close. The prediction is this. So here you see, I have reversed the picture for the critical field that I showed you before. Here, on the x-axis, you have the applied magnetic field. And what you do, you imagine cooling the system. So you have two films, one in a cavity and the other bare. You cool them and check at what temperature they become superconducting. Now, the plots are given on the y-axis. We plot not the temperature, but the reduced temperature, namely the temperature in H field for which the films come back to the normal state over the critical temperature of the zero field case. So in this way, possible shifts of the critical temperature in zero field are eliminated. Okay, we show everything in terms of reduced temperature. Why we do that? Because people know, people who make up, who construct superconducting films, that the critical temperature of a film itself changes from samples to sample. It's very difficult to have two samples fabricated in the same way also that have precisely the same critical temperature to the accuracy that we need. So we express everything in terms of reduced temperatures to get rid of this effect. Now, the Aladdin experiment. The first part was the theoretical proposal. We went to INFN with our proposal. They approved it and gave us money to do the experiment. The experiment is called Aladdin experiment, and it is a collaboration with these people, people from the Seconda Università di Napoli, people from the Institute for Photonic Technology in Jena who prepared our films, our samples, and finally the group of us from Naples University. Now, this is my last slide. The results are preliminary. The results which I show you on this slide have been taken, the measurements have been taken only a few months ago, and this is what happens. So, first notice, that you see, the experiment consists in the following. You compared the critical fields for the two samples, okay? So it's very important to make sure that they are placed, they feel exactly the same magnetic field to a large accuracy. So in order to achieve that, the bare film and the cavity are deposited within, using the same deposition on the same chip at a very small distance from each other, let's say less than a millimeter. 200, 300 microns. In this way, if you put them inside a solenoid, you can be sure that they will see the same magnetic field to a large precision. Then in our measurement, as I told you, we fix H and we cool the system slowly. And then measure the critical temperature by means of a resistance measurement on the samples for the bare film and the cavity and compare the two. Now, this is an example of a measurement. Here there are the, so H is fixed. Here there are two curves which refer to the bare sample. There are two curves because they are taking at two different times. Now our apparatus shows a slowly time drift in the values of the critical temperatures for the films, but it is linear. So in order to have a precise estimate, we take two measurements on the bare film at same time distance from the central measurement on the cavity. And then for the critical temperature of the bare film, we take the average of the two measurements. Okay? In this way, if you plot the result, this is what came out from the first run of measurements. So the errors are, you see, are very small, 6 microkelvin. So the sensitivity is, in fact, large, huge. But the errors are just comparable with the magnitude of the effect. So the numbers are, have the correct, say, the same order of magnitude that we predicted on the basis of the theory for our system, which is made of aluminum, aluminum oxide, and gold. Aluminum is superconducting with a TC of order 1 Kelvin. So the curves, the lower curve is for the Casimir system. The upper curve is for the bare film. So they are in the right position, let's say, one with respect to the other. We don't understand why they merge so quickly here. This is something that we don't understand. But certainly we are planning now to make more measurements this fall in a new laboratory in Seconda Università di Napoli. First, we have to check the dependence of this shift on the width of the cavity, which is really the signature of the Casimir effect. This we couldn't do so far because the samples that were shipped to us from Jena had always the same thickness of aluminum oxide. So this we haven't done yet. And then we plan to use films with lower critical temperature, zinc perhaps, because as I told you, no, that I didn't tell you, but when you consider materials with low critical temperatures, the condensation energy typically diminishes quickly, becomes smaller, smaller and smaller. So the effect becomes larger for materials with low critical temperature. Ideally, the best material for this type of experiment would be beryllium. Beryllium is toxic. You cannot use it easily in a laboratory. So we couldn't use that. We have used aluminum for the moment, but we plan to go to zinc in the next run. So here are a few references to the work which I have told you about. The conclusions, we propose to use superconducting cavities to measure variations of Casimir energy across phase transitions. This is a novel approach since all experiments so far are force measurements. Now, what is an advantage perhaps of our procedure? You see, we have rigid systems. No, we have 3-layer systems in which are solid. So it's rather easy to produce them in different geometries. And so perhaps this is a good means of studying geometric effects on the shape dependence of the Casimir energy in a system. Another thing which is interesting, which I told you about earlier, is the possibility of that this type of experiment may give hints on how to describe the thermal contribution to the Casimir effect in metallic systems, which has to do with an ambiguity in the estimate of the zero mode T, the zero T mode, namely low frequency part of the Casimir force. Now, since, as I told you, the superconducting transition affects only the low part of the spectrum, it is perhaps a good approach to probe how to properly describe low frequency modes in the Casimir effect. This is all. Thank you.
One question. You referred to the spatial dispersion from the Lipschitz theorem. You said that can be generalized to the spatial.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that? You just put in epsilon of k or what?
No, what I mean is that, you see, you can write the Lipschitz formula in terms of the reflection amplitudes as functions of omega and the wave vector for the plates. This formula, as it stands, can be proven in full generality. I mean, even if the plates are dispersive, spatially dispersive, this formula is still valid. Okay? The issue that you have to address when you have spatial dispersion is what expression you use for the reflection coefficients. That is a separate problem now, which has nothing to do with Lifshitz, with Casimir effects.
So dispersion, spatial dispersion would be in the plates, but not in the medium in between.
No, the medium is either empty, okay, or in our case it's an oxide, which is an insulator. So no problem. It has to do with metallic plates, especially at low temperature. Or depending on the set, well, yeah, especially at low temperatures. But this is, now it is known. Initially, you see, it was thought that Lifshitz formula would apply only to local media, spatially local media, initially. Now it is known that this is not true. It is completely general, because there are derivations of Lifshitz formula which don't look at all at the interior of the plates. So they can do whatever you want. You can you just have two plates and describe them phenomenologically by means of reflection coefficients, depending on the frequency and on the wave vector. No? You don't care who gives you these reflection coefficients. They are there. Then, using them, you can prove Lifshitz theory by just looking at the electromagnetic field in the empty gap between the plates. This is now well known, let's say. There are lots of derivations of this. So it is, I would say, clear. The problem is that in case of dispersion, you don't know exactly what to take for the reflection amplitudes. It becomes slightly more difficult. It can be done anyhow. There are works which address this issue. But BCS theory becomes much more complicated when you have...
You were thinking of very thin films.
Yeah.
What if one of these, I mean, you had a big, thick...
gold plate.
Yes. And my guess originally was that maybe there will be, once you go through the superconductive transition, and a change at the level of the skin depth, and that whether the separation was something or something plus or minus skin depth would be something that would
make a difference.
Yeah, and that's not the case.
What I can tell you is that from our simulations, numerical simulations, one finds that as the separation becomes smaller and smaller,
yes,
the Casimir energy goes to a constant. It approaches a constant value. It does not increase as it happens in vacuum. I'm talking of the change of Casimir energy. Change of Casimir energy. So the change of Casimir energy approaches a constant. But this is understandable because, I guess, when the separation between the plates is very small, high energy modes contribute most to the effect. And then the superconducting transition is going perhaps to be, how can I say, perhaps, well, is going to attend to a constant compared to these huge frequencies that you have far away.
This calculation that gives this result, do you use reflection coefficient or do you use the Lifshitz formula with epsilon of omega?
In practice, I use epsilon of omega, given by the BCS theory.
So you think there may be differences on reflection and you use skin effect?
Taking account, no, skin effect is taken into account when you use the BCS reflectivity, no? Skin effect is there. What you are neglecting is spatial dispersion inside the plates, but skin effect is there. I'm not, because, usually people consider as a first order approximation in Casimir situations the ideal case. Now, our effect is due precisely to the fact that the mirrors are not ideal. Right? Because if I describe them as ideal in both states, I don't have any change of Casimir energy. So we are really looking at deviations from the ideal case.
Yes.
Now, the skin effect is there when you have a frequency-dependent permittivity which is not infinite, which has to be, right? So what? The only thing that I suppose is that we neglect spatial dispersion. But you see, for us, I don't think that this will change the order of magnitudes. Experience of other people with spatial dispersion is that normally spatial dispersion gives only a tiny correction to the Casimir energy. So orders of magnitude are, I guess, right.
Have you considered superconducting films that display first order transition to superconductivity? So
They must be thick.
Thick films of,
now,
of
you see, thick, no, it's not good for us, because we want to have the condensation energy of the film as small as possible. So if you take thick films, the condensation energy grows with the thickness. And so you are killed. I need thin films, but not exceedingly thin, because if they are exceedingly thin, they become transparent. And so there is no more any Casimir effect. In fact, from our simulations, there is an optimal range of thicknesses where the effect is maximum, because you have a decent amount of reflection and at the same time a low condensation energy. And the thickness is about 10 nanometers. So if I go thick, I'm finished.
Could you show me the data again?
Yes. I'm a theoretician, I say. So don't be... I don't know if I can tell too much about... let's see. Perhaps it's faster like this. Okay.
If you were to plot the scale and change the, due to the drifting magnetic field on the right hand side, what would it look like?
Here? You are talking of this part of the.
No, I'm talking about the left, lower left.
Ah, here. Yes.
We have a drift in your
magnetic field. A thermal drift. No. If we measure the critical field for the bare film at different times, we find slightly different values.
Understand that. And you take the average of those. But
yeah.
If you would not take the average and would just plot basically the error you get by averaging this magnetic field or interpolating it, what would it look like on the right hand side?
I don't know. Now this, I don't know. Because I haven't personally analyzed this data. This has been done by our experimental colleagues. In
because you're saying you have a resolution of about...
Yeah, 6 microkelvin. Look at the scale. Yes, here there is a difference of 100 microkelvin, right? In the fourth digit, a few hundred microkelvins. So this region, this is huge, no? Compared to this thing. So you are telling one has to be careful how one takes the average. Well, what I can tell you is that how the average was taken. We took, assuming, because that we know, the drift is linear, the time intervals elapsed between these two measurements and these two is the same, and so we just take the mean. This is what we did, because everything goes linearly. This we know. The drift is a slow linear thing. But I don't know if other... ways of
your experiment also takes a while, doesn't it?
Takes a while. Each this curve, I think, not much. Perhaps minutes,
okay.
Seconds, minutes, each measurement, not hours or days. I mean, the time intervals here, I don't remember. I think it's a few minutes only. Because it's a fast measurement, you see, you just have to make a resistance measurement. It's very quick. I think it's minutes at most. But this I can trace in our papers if you are interested. I don't remember. So in my opinion, it will be very important to check dependence of the effect on the width. Because who knows, perhaps we are... who knows?
L is the cavity, isn't it?
It's the width. It's the width of the cavity.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry for my English. You don't need PowerPoint, right?
No.